Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Coming up on this edition, the guest is Jonathan Abrams. He is a Bleacher Report writer, and you may know him as well from Grantland and the New York Times. But he is on here today because he has just published a book, All the Pieces Matter, The Inside Story of The Wire. It is a 300-plus page book that is a oral history of The Wire, and Jonathan Abrams talks to every person behind the scenes of this remarkable HBO show, as well as just about every actor who has appeared on the show. It is a phenomenal, phenomenal book. And if you're a Wire fan, I would say it's absolutely must buy and must read. And we talk about how Jonathan was able to put this together, some of the interviews, the memorable interviews that he did, as well as just Jonathan giving us a sense from talking to everybody at The Wire, what seasons were the best, what seasons had the most impact. So if you are a Wire fan, I think you're really, really going to enjoy this. It's Jonathan Abrams, the author of The Inside Story of The Wire, coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, and as promised, we bring in Jonathan Abrams. He is the author of All the Pieces Matter, The Inside Story of The Wire. It is a remarkable oral history of arguably the greatest show that we have seen in our lifetime, and Jonathan Abrams joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Jonathan, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Richard.
All right, as I've said on Twitter, I think the book is fantastic. If you're a Wire fan, saying it's a must-read is sort of, almost think it's not enough in terms of a push. So I want to start, Jonathan, with some top-line stuff, just so people get a sense of how you went about reporting this. How many interviews did you conduct for the book?
I mean, I never counted, but I think by the end I had a couple thousand pages of transcripts. So, I mean, if you had just seen The Wire being filmed in Baltimore, I was trying to talk to you for this book.
One of the things I read in the at the end of the book was that this idea was proposed by an agent, correct? This was not your idea. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could take credit for it. I was a Wire fan for a very, very long time, but it was my literary agent's idea. Shout out to Daniel Greenberg, and once he said it, I was like, yes, yes, yes.
How does it work? How did your agent, literary agent, first propose this to you, as specific as you want to be?
I want to say I think we were just spitballing ideas after I had finished up with my first book, Boys Among Men. We were trying to think of what to do next, and he came across that.
What was out there in terms of when you did the research of, okay, I'm a huge fan of The Wire, this could be a very, very cool project, but obviously you want to see what's out there already in terms of, has anything close to this been done? So when you did your research, what'd you find?
Yeah, so there's The Wire isn't a show that lacks for stuff that's been written about, that's for sure. Britt Martin has a great book out called Difficult Men that's about the Davids, David Chase and David Simon, and I'm forgetting the third David because it was a show I didn't watch. But
David Milch, right?
That one. And that was a great book, and that provides a lot of the backstory for how The Wire came together. Alan Sepinwall has a book on TV about TV's revolution into prestige television that was really good. And then David Simon, if you read his two nonfiction books, Homicide in the Corner, that he did with Ed Burns, his co-creator on The Wire, it's a real book. It's based on, you know, all accounts that David Simon had in the Baltimore Police Department and then on the corners of Baltimore, but they're really, really good, and you can kind of see the foundation for The Wire taking place in those books.
I love the oral history format. But it is not easy to produce something great, in my opinion. Obviously, you need the content to be great, and this book is. So as detailed as you can, because I think there are going to be a lot of people out here listening who may want to either approach an oral history in terms of a magazine-type piece or maybe try, like you did, in book form. How do you go about approaching the structure of this book in terms of where to start, what's the middle, what's the end? When you, and maybe for you, it turned, it changed during the process of the project. But it's such a monumental task given all the interviews that you did. So how did you go about trying to structure this?
Well, something like this was relatively easy to structure because, you know, you're doing the origin story, then you're doing once they get off the ground and go from season one to season two to three, four, five, and then the legacy of the show. So the structure wasn't necessarily the problem. I think oral histories are always tricky because there can be too many voices and you have to try to keep everything straight in your head and go through a million transcripts. And if you don't have kind of the perfect quote that you need to think of how you can get from point A to point B. I mean, this is coming from a person who's, you know, done a lot of feature stories and narrative stories where it's just my own voice. I can definitely say that putting oral histories together are tougher than just straight writing it out.
Where did you start with this book? Was there a particular chapter or season of The Wire you started? Did you start after? I know the preface sort of starts with Wendell Pierce talking to a Columbia University crowd in 2016, but, you know, I imagine you could have started this book anywhere. How'd you determine where you wanted to start, at least with the oral history part?
Well, I mean, because I was actually at that event at Columbia, and it was kind of like a gathering together of Wire thinkers, and it was really kind of cool to be at where you had all these academic people and a few of the actors and actresses from The Wire all coming together, and I thought that would be the perfect place to start because here we are in 2016, like you said, and we're still talking about a show that now it's been a decade since it's been off the air, but we're talking about it like it just went off the air yesterday.
I want to ask you that. Why do you think that is? Why? I mean, the show is obviously brilliant, so you understand why it sort of touched people, at least who watched it. But the show now in 2018, as you know, Jonathan, it's dissected. There are university classes on it. Its relevance might even be bigger today, given what's going on in this country. Why do you think The Wire still resonates, even though it hasn't had a first-run episode in a decade?
I think it's eternal. I mean, you look at the problems that The Wire was presenting, whether it was the war on drugs or whether it was police officers giving kids the rough rides, and it was a show on fiction, but you see that stuff play out in real life all the time. And I think as long as those problems are still there, society, I mean, the show is going to be relevant because David Simon's whole thing was that he never tried to present any answers, but he was trying to be honest about what the problems were. And hey, let's at least be honest that we have these problems and these issues, and let's try to figure out a way to solve them. And I don't think we've necessarily done that.
At what point do you let David Simon know about this project, and what is his initial reaction when you say, I want to do an oral history on what you created?
So this is funny. That was like the first thing I had to do, right? I was gung-ho about it after my agent mentioned it, and then it's like, okay, but we have to get David Simon to give us permission, because if he doesn't, it's DOA, right?
Right.
All the actors and everybody is going to ask David, hey, is this cool? Are you participating in this? And you know, if he says no, then I'm not going to be able to get to anybody. So I wrote like this long email telling him why The Wire was important to me and how I wanted to honor the legacy of the show, and just really heartfelt. And I think his reply from his assistant was something like, he can do whatever he wants, or just something like that. I mean, it was like the biggest green light I had ever gotten, though, but it was like really like blasé response, which I would have expected from him.
That's funny. So what was the first conversation like with David Simon? Do you do that over the phone, or do you fly to wherever he is so you guys can meet in person and have the first interview, the first long interview, one-on-one, where you're looking at each other?
So this is actually another funny story, because I lived in New York for 5 years when I wrote for the New York Times, and so I know the whole subway system, and I think I have it down. I come into New York, and Simon says that he can talk to me while he's taking this train from New York to Boston. I think he was giving a speech at Harvard that day. So I'm supposed to meet him at Penn Station, say at like 9 in the morning, and I had stayed on the Upper West Side. And I know the trains, I'm just going to take the express train for a couple stops. And for whatever reason, I guess it's more typical since I've left New York, there was so much traffic and the trains were delayed that I must have gotten on that train to Boston with like 25 seconds to spare. And then when I saw David, he saw me like out of breath and like huffing, and like I think he was a bit concerned, like, who the heck is this crazy guy? But he was good. He told me to just like calm down and catch my breath.
So you're talking to him from New York to Boston. That's it's at least 2.5-3 hours. I imagine that conversation, you must have known after that conversation, wow, like I have something really great here. Given that if you get the founder of this for that long, I got to imagine you're going to get some interesting stuff.
Yeah, and what was even like greater for me for the project is that I think I had talked to Ed Burns, Simon's co-creator, before that. Yeah. And Ed Burns is like this like intelligent, brilliant recluse, basically, who just shuns Hollywood. He hasn't gone on to do much since The Wire, but he's like this brilliant guy where he was in the Baltimore Police Department for a long time, and then he went on to become a middle school teacher, and that's where a lot of the stuff from season 4 is created from. And he talked to me for several hours, where even just beyond the show, like I just felt like I just learned so much about life. And a treat of form with him, I was, after the book was completed, I was like, hey, you want a copy? You want me to send you one? He was like, no, that's okay.
Do you have any idea why? I mean, Ed Burns, obviously, if you read the oral history of The Wire, if you read your book, you can sort of tell just what the actors think of him and sort of his creative importance on this entire enterprise. But if he's a recluse, why do you think he decided to talk about it? You know, if he's shunning Hollywood and shunning press, yet he clearly opened up to you.
Honestly, I don't know, and I didn't ask, and I think I'm just fortunate. You know, I think after David had said okay that he would talk to me for it, his assistant helped me get in touch with Ed and helped me get in touch with George Pelicanos and Nina Noble and like the brain trust that put the show together. So, you know, he really helped with that green light, and his assistant Rena was awesome in helping me put this together.
In the book, Jonathan, you write, I think maybe this is in the afterword, that you got Michael B. Jordan is the first actor you interviewed. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Bill Simmons helped me get in touch with him.
So right, you're a former Grantland staffer. Bill Simmons helps you get in touch with him. How long, roughly, do you interview Michael B. Jordan that first time?
I want to say for somewhere between a half an hour and 45 minutes. You know, it was kind of a shame that, spoiler alert, he doesn't make it too far in The Wire world.
So right.
He couldn't talk to subsequent seasons about the character of Wallace. But, I mean, he was great, and he was talking about that as his first role, and that's when he really fell in love with acting. And Andre Royo, the actor who played Bubbles, was really instrumental as far as helping Michael B. Jordan get in the headspace to play Wallace.
Yeah, and we'll get to Andre in a second, because he's, I think, he may be the person, if there's one actor who sort of, you know, really carries this oral history, it might be him. I mean, you hear obviously from everybody who was on the show, but he's really particularly poignant. The interesting thing that you wrote about Michael B. Jordan was that you got Michael B. Jordan, and then for a while, you were having trouble getting other people. Then Alexa L. Fogel, the casting director of The Wire, comes into your life. Can you explain to the audience how she ended up helping you get so many of these actors?
Yeah, shout out to Alexa. Without her, there would definitely be no book. So she cast Oz, she cast The Wire, she's just recently cast The Deuce. And I think she's a little bit like me, where she's this quiet person, but the gears are always churning in her head. And so when I sat down with her and talked to her for this interview, she was living in New York, actually not far away from where I used to live in New York. And she was just really, really believed in this project and felt that the show didn't get recognized enough when it was on air. So she really, really wanted to see this through. And because my background is sports writing, so I would email these Hollywood publicists, and they wouldn't know who I was, and you know, it would come CC back with like 5 or 6 different names if I would just email one person. And it was tough going for a little bit, but she was instrumental. She helped me to be able to interview Idris Elba and Dominic West, and at one point she was like determined to get me Wood Harris, the guy who played Avon Barksdale, because it had been months and months, and we were almost ready to go to print, and I hadn't got him yet, and she delivered.
What when you would let's take either Idris Elba or Dominic West. Obviously, they've become in Idris's case, obviously major Hollywood type star. Dominic West has been on multiple shows since, and again, sort of a major actor. What is the process like in terms of getting these guys? For people who are not journalists or who are not part of that world, how do you go about trying to get somebody at that level of stardom?
You know, I think I started off with some of the lesser-known characters and tried to build my way up from there. So, you know, I would send a list to the publicists of everybody who I would talk to. And Isaiah Whitlock, the actor who played Clay Davis, was a great example of this because at the beginning, when I hadn't talked to that many people, his publicist said no. And then come back a couple months later after I'd shown them everybody who I'd talked to and doesn't Isaiah want to be a part of this? This is really trying to honor the show's legacy.
Right.
And afterwards, they say yes.
Smart. So you're using using other interviews to get new interviews, which I think a lot of times also happens, as you know, in the sports world. Was there for you a moment where things changed, where like, you know, you interview Michael B. Jordan, it's a while since you get anybody else, then obviously you're getting a little bit of help and you're getting some interviews. What was the moment when you were like, I got it, this is going to be a book, even if you have 20, 30 interviews left? At what point of the process did you know that like it was coming together where you could put together this project?
Probably after I had talked to David Simon, because even though he had said yes to the project, it was still a few months into it before I had been able to arrange anything with him. And I had gone back and forth with his assistant for months, and they were, you know, getting ready to put together the Deuce. So he was really busy. But after I talked to him, I knew that I had something. But I am going to tell you this. So you read the book. There's two people I really wanted to get, but one is a big person who I wasn't able to land. Then this is out of hundreds of characters, but did you catch who it was?
Say what else you're going to say, and then let me see if I can guess.
Well, I mean, I think that was it. I mean, I think once I talked to David, that was when I knew that I had a book. There's always like a moment where it's almost like a click you hear in your brain, and you're like, okay, I have a story, I have a book. We can go from here. I can get some sleep at night.
All right. So I basically was just stalling there as I was pulling up my wire cast.
Is going to give it away, but he has like the most famous gift that is out there.
Why am I blanking? You talk to Michael Kay, you talk to Idris, you talk to Wendell, you talk to Andres.
He needed his fish to be taken care of.
Why am I blanking? Give it to me. I'm blanking.
It's Wee Bay.
Oh, yeah. Duh. What happened there?
So this was pretty early on in the process, but his publicist asked for like...
money?
I don't even know if he ever got the request. Yes, his publicist asked for like $700, and it was a really like specific number.
Yeah, random request. Hassan Johnson played Wee Bay, right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, right.
And I really loved his character too, but I didn't get him. And then the other person I didn't get was Clark Johnson, who played Gus in season 5, but more than that, he directed the first two episodes and the last two episodes of the series, but for whatever reason, I couldn't get him.
Boy, that's
and
odd.
This, and Clark, was, just, this Clark, was out of a lot of people, though.
Right, and Clark Johnson was a well-known actor on Homicide, so obviously very close to David Simon. That's surprising, just given he's acted for a long time, and obviously huge, important part of the newspaper storyline. In the final season of The Wire. You know what? Now that I think about it, having read the book, you're right. Though you referenced him, I don't remember hearing from him. There was I should ask you this. On average, how long were the interviews like on average a very similar amount? Or clearly for some people you interview them multiple times, but as a general rule, how long would you get with each person?
I don't think there was any specific time limit. I mean, I think I would talk to them as long as they wanted to talk. So, I mean, I was trying to put together the best book I could, and I wasn't trying to leave anything out. So as long as people could talk, I was on the phone with them.
There clearly, when you read this, for the people who read this book, you'll see that Andre Arroyo, who played Bubbles, he really, I thought, Jonathan, just he gave you so much, clearly so much of his time, but also I just think so much of his passion and thoughtfulness and intelligence. It clearly struck you too, right? That he is one of the, if not the sort of biggest voice I felt like in this book, in terms of really having a sense of, maybe outside of David Simon, obviously, and Ed Burns, as to why this show mattered so much.
Yeah, to me, Andre, Bubbles, at least in the show, was the heart of the show. And to me, he was really the heart of the book. When you're trying to do something as big as this, you're looking for somebody to just be honest, no matter if it makes him look good or bad or whatever. Don't try to change history. Just try to be honest. And his memory was incredible. I mean, he put me in places through his words, and he was funny. He was smart. He was everything I ever could have asked for in an interview. I mean, I think that was one of the best interviews ever in my life.
Where did you do that one? Where did that take place?
That one was actually over the phone.
Wow. And was it multiple times or just one long interview?
Nope, just one go that lasted, I want to say, close to 3 hours.
Wow. Good for you. That's really impressive interviewing by you, because I would have guessed for sure you would have gone back to him a couple times, just given the kind of stuff he gave you. That's
you know, the funny thing is that he's such a good talker that I don't even remember asking too many questions. You know, he's just one of those guys who you just pop a question and then you look and it's like 10 or 15 minutes later.
That's one where you're just hoping the batteries or the iPhone is just charged up and it's working. When this is a good question that came in from a reader. When writing an oral history, what do you do to make sure the tone and nuances of each speaker come through accurately and in full?
I mean, I'm just giving complete quotes. How they said it is what makes it onto the page. So I don't think you have to do anything other to capture nuance other than just be accurate with what they say.
It seems to me, Jonathan, that one of the hardest things about a project like this is determining what to cut and what makes it. So philosophically, how did you go about, I'll ask you obviously how you transcribed, you probably outsourced it, but philosophically, how did you do that? What's the process of determining what makes the page and what ends up on the cutting room floor?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first draft of this book may have been like double the length. That was how much good stuff I felt I had. And to be honest, pulling some stuff was like pulling organs. They already told me that I was too far, had too many words on the page. So it was tough. If somebody duplicates a quote, you have to take that out. You just try to keep the story moving. But a lot of the things that I did cut, it was tough. And I've been putting a lot of that stuff up on Twitter and stuff. But and as far as the transcribing stuff, yeah, that was outsourced. A lot of money went to rev.com.
yeah, I can imagine and would they basically then send you back, you send out however you taped it, and they send you back either PDFs or Microsoft Word of the entire transcription of the interview?
Yeah, they send back the Microsoft Words of it, and then I obviously read through the transcripts as I'm listening to the tape to make sure it's accurate. Because for a while, I think when I wrote my first book, I started getting carpal tunnel syndrome. And more so than that, it was affecting my jumper during pickup, so I tried to stop doing that as much.
That's funny. Do you have an idea roughly of how many words overall were transcribed? Even obviously all of them couldn't come close to being in the book, but do you know the final word count when you transcribed all the interviews?
I never looked. I think it would scare me.
Yeah, it might be in the millions, given the amount of interviews that you did. Was there, you mentioned the two people that you did not interview for the book that you wanted to. Was there anyone else who falls under that? Somebody either who was an actor on the show or a behind-the-scenes person who you wanted to interview that for whatever reason you did not You did not interview.
No. I was really, really happy with the amount of people that I was able to get to. That cast and crew is so big that I knew that for whatever reasons I wouldn't be able to get everybody. You know, just probability speaking, there's so many people that I wouldn't be able to land everybody. The actor who played Prop Joe, his name was Robert Chu. He passed away a couple years ago, and I would have loved to have talked to him because it just seems like he was just this amazing, amazing person that everybody looked up to. And he didn't just play Prop Joe on the show, but he was also taught children acting, and he was crucial as far as those boys in season 4, getting them to understand the roles and the depth of the characters that they were about to play.
I will get to some of these seasons in a second, but since you just brought it up, the four boys in season 4, are they all currently acting now?
The guy who played Dookie is a singer, Jermaine Crawford. I know Maestro, the guy who played Randy, is acting, and Tristan Wilds is acting and singing, and Halito McCollum, who played Naaman, is still acting. So, yeah, they're all in entertainment in some type of form.
One of the things I thought that was really clear from reading the book is that most of the actors on the show, even 10 years later, and obviously some of the behind-the-scenes people, some of the writers, et cetera, there remains a frustration among everyone twofold. One, that the show clearly did not get, I think it's just due, during its original run. But more than that, it's that nothing really has changed. Like, they did this show that sort of explored this inner city in America, and so much of the same problems exist 10 years later. Did you, in talking to, let's take the first part for a second, did you still sense a frustration, especially among the cast, that the show just never received its due, including Emmys and awards and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them, I think, don't care about it and have let it go since it's been a very long time. And let's be honest, that was a tough show to watch week to week. If you're not binging it, if you're just dropping in that world for just an hour and then have to wait a whole another week, because that's how The Wire came on when it was on. You couldn't stream shows or anything when it first came on. So right. It was a little bit difficult. Lance Riddick, the actor who played Lieutenant Daniels, said that The Wire not getting any Emmys, that's something he's going to be pissed off about until the day that he dies. So, yeah, that's definitely there with some of them.
Did Lance or others say that the reason they thought that was because it was a show mostly cast with people of color, mostly about people of color?
Yes.
What do you want to expand on that? What was there anything that either a cast member or a creator said that really struck you, and that maybe it really was gave you an example of sort of Hollywood, or maybe not Hollywood in this case, but the Emmy world tends to favor a certain type of show?
Well, I think the actor Reggie Cathy, who unfortunately passed away a couple days ago, he had a quote where he said that if you have a neighborhood where it's 70% black and everything is the same as this other neighborhood that's 70% white, the economics are the same, the people have the same type of jobs, et cetera, that no matter what, the 70% neighborhood that's white is going to be looked at as superior by the majority. And that's how they felt about how people voted when it came to The Wire.
Yeah, sadly passed away a couple of days ago. Just a brilliant actor. What about, Jonathan, the people who in the book who sort of talked to you, and again, I think there were some actors and certainly the behind the scenes, the writers and stuff, who basically, like we're saying, 10 years later, nothing's really changed. The same, you know, the same arguments are being made. The sort of the same policies exist. What would your takeaway from how they viewed America in 2018 versus what they were putting on film a decade ago?
Well, I mean, I think it's a sense of disappointment. I think that's one of David Simon's larger issues, is that a lot of times when people talk about the show, they're talking about, you know, who was cooler, Omar or Stringer Bell, where he was trying to present these arguments about these institutions that are failing us, and nobody's really paying attention like he would like about these arguments that he presented. And you know, even more recently, even after I was done reporting for this book, you know, you hear about Jeff Sessions trying to bring back the war on drugs, and you're like, you know, The Wire was a fictional show, but so much of it was sourced in truth. And you see how their season one basically showed how the whole war on drugs is just a fallacy.
Hmm. Did you go to Baltimore so you could see this world yourself?
I did.
What can you tell me about that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Baltimore a few times already. I have a sister who used to live in Baltimore. So, I mean, it was, you know, not a situation I was unfamiliar with. You know, I do hope that I represented the city well.
All right, let's take a break from our conversation with Jonathan to talk about Mattress Firm. Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed. From adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor, they have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast now to see what deals are happening. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. All right, a couple more here, and let's this obviously is something that when you are doing your press tour for this book, I guess this interview counts as that, you're going to be asked about what is your favorite season, what do you think the best season is. There's so much discussion about what's the best season of The Wire. George Pelicanos in your book mentioned season 3 and 4. It feels to me most people say 4, season that focuses on those 4 kids and sort of how the system sort of lets them down. How will you answer that question when people in the next couple weeks ask you, what do you think the best season of The Wire is and why?
I mean, I'm going to be real original and say season 4. That was the first season that I watched in real time, and then I had to go back and catch up on the other 3 seasons. And I remember that was when Netflix was just doing the DVDs, so I would watch like 4 episodes in one setting and then have to wait like 2, 3, 4 days to get the next DVD for it, for the other seasons. But I mean, that just showed why these kids couldn't pull themselves up by their bootstraps and the hurdles that they face, where a kid like Dookie never has a chance at all, or a kid like Michael can't really focus on school because he has to take care of his little brother. And even if he wants to be legitimate, those opportunities aren't there for him. So I'll say 4. I will also say that, you know, after talking to these actors and the creators of the show, that season 2 has definitely grown on me as far as its importance in building out the scope of the world and the balls that David Simon had to have to create this show that nobody has ever seen before and say, we're going to flip it on its head and bring in this whole new cast of characters, and you're still going to have continuing storylines, but I'm also going to make you see what these characters are going through as well.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. I thought Simon and Ed Burns and stuff, when they were talking about the Sabacca season, which is season 2, and it's fascinating to just even in your book hear the actors are like, what the hell is going on? Like, why are we not basically going to be on this show now for multiple weeks? But I think in hindsight, I think you're right. I feel like season 2 is probably, at the time, did not get nearly the credit it deserves. And now I think when you look at it with a little bit of distance, it holds up well. Do you agree? At least it holds up well for the first couple seasons.
I do. And it's really weird because, you know, all the actors from season 1, a lot of them were pissed off that a lot of their screen time was getting taken away from these actors that they had never seen or heard from before. But that was also the year that they brought on a lot of white cast members, so the show opened up to a whole different viewership. So right. That was the most well-watched season in real time was season 2, even though,
I didn't know that.
You know, a lot of those people, when they take all the seasons together, they automatically dismiss and throw out season 2.
And I think, and season two, obviously, Amy Ryan, who went on to be, I think, Academy Award nominee. So some interesting names from season two. How do you feel?
You know how long it took me to realize that she was in The Office, and I watched The Office in real time too before I realized that was her.
You didn't realize Amy Ryan is the same Amy Ryan?
It took a while.
Yeah, she's had an interesting career. If you look at her IMDb resume, there. What do you? You know, there's so much. There's so much sort of debate, I feel like, among the Wire heads about season five. There would be some who think, you know, especially if you're in the journalism or newspaper business, it was fascinating. There are those who probably think it should have ended after four, and that season five was just David Simon fighting with HBO to get one more 10-episode run. You know, it's an interesting season, not to mention the fact that Scott Templeton, the actor Tom McCarthy, goes on to direct Spotlight. I find season five kind of fascinating. I'm sure part of that is just because of the business that me and you are in, but that always is a debated season about, you know, where it ranks among the other seasons. How do you view season five?
I mean, I think that we're different because we're in this industry. So I think I was near the end of my term at the Los Angeles Times, where a lot of those things that he was writing about was something that was going on in real life. The LA Times was a Tribune company when I was there, and they were going through buyouts, it seemed like, left and right. And that was, you know, really, you know, you were seeing your friends lose their jobs. So that was really, really interesting to watch in real time because of how accurate it was and how much stuff he got right. You know, that season, I really, really wish it had a couple more episodes. And I know David Simon had wanted it to have a couple more episodes because I think that you would have seen more depth to Scott Templeton's character, where it was kind of just a little bit one-sided, which is atypical for a character in the Wire's universe.
Yep.
But I think season five, you have to give it its due because of the final episode of the series. And, you know, I remember hitting into the finale wondering how in the world he was going to be able to close off so many storylines. And I just felt like that finale was perfect.
You discussed this, we're sort of flipping back here. This is in the first season, the fourth episode, the famous fuck scene, which is I one of the great scenes in any drama ever on television, where the characters McNulty and Bunk, they're investigating the scene of a murder, they're putting together the clues, and the only thing they say in the entire scene is the word fuck or a variation of fuck. We now have the explicit title on this podcast, Jonathan. When you are writing about that, which must have been so much fun, and interviewing people about that, what were your takeaways from that scene? There's basically never, in my opinion, been another scene like that on television.
I mean, I could just imagine how Dominic West and Wendell Pierce were when they saw that script. And it was like, Bunk, fuck. McNulty, fuck. Bunk, fuck. I mean, that would have been just hilarious to have seen their eyes like the first time they saw that script. But as far as watching that, I mean, you can tell like perfectly like what they're thinking throughout that whole scene, even though they only use that one word. When I was transcribing it, I was like, how many U's do I use in this one versus the next one versus how they said it? But yeah, that's an all-time favorite scene.
Did the actor, when you asked them, did the actors, whether you asked Wendell or Dominic, did they enjoy that scene? Did they enjoy it as actors?
Yeah, I think they did. And Dominic West said that there was so many other versions of him saying the word fuck and for different variations and timing and sequences that a lot of it got left on the cutting room floor.
By the way, Dominic West, in your book, he sort of, I think, is a little hard on himself, but how impressive, guy from England coming in and doing a pretty good Baltimore accent, in my opinion.
I mean, I think he was honest. He was like, half the stuff McNulty was saying, Dominic West was like, I don't understand what he's saying.
Right. it was really funny. All right, a couple more here. What is interesting, though, is that 10 years later, when you're reading the actors, you know, whether it's Andre or Idris Elba, basically, I would say this is true for everybody that you interviewed. They all sort of had an they all now have an understanding. Maybe they had it then, too. But they all now have an understanding that they were part of something far larger than themselves and far larger than television. What did you make of that when you just were hearing these actors say that they recognized that they were part of something bigger than just an entertainment vehicle? They were part of a show that really said something where most entertainment vehicles do not.
So I think the first thing, at least for a lot of the Black cast members, were that they had never been part of a crew as diverse before. I mean, so that was one reason why they wanted to come together and really present something that was strong. And then as the show went on and as the show continued and as they started seeing what the message was and kind of the hidden meaning behind the show, because David Simon wouldn't tell these guys what was going to happen week to week. They were finding out on a weekly basis of where their characters were going and what was going to go on. They started to have a greater appreciation and a deeper understanding of what the show meant and what it would ultimately stand for, even when not a lot of people in real time were actually tuning in.
I think, before I ever ask this, do you think the show can be duplicated, Jonathan? You think we could see something like this in 2018? Would think a network would commit to this kind of television?
You know, I keep hearing good things about The Chi, although I'll be honest, I haven't seen it yet. But I do wonder if I hear a lot of comparisons about The Wire. I don't know if it can be duplicated or replicated, because you look at the type of talent that came out of that cast where we didn't really know who they were at that time. And now we look at movie stars like Idris Elba and Dominic West and Michael B. Jordan. I mean, that was like a dream team that nobody knew was a dream team yet.
Yeah, look at all the people who then went on, not even if it's not movie stardom, Michael Kay, Williams goes on to Boardwalk Empire. I mean, you could go through the whole list and just see so much, so many of their future projects became just major, major either films or television productions, including, we just mentioned before, Tom McCarthy directed Spotlight. He directed an Academy Award-winning Best Picture. You are correct about that. It's an amazing group. Here are the last three things I want to get to. It struck me when reading your book, just how unbelievable it was for David Simon to have brought in some of these writers to write the show. Richard Price was just a major, major writer at the time. I mean, one of the best writers out there, Pelicanos. It was were you sort of blown away by me that when you sort of look back, just how Simon and Ed Burns were able to get like these major, major novelists to come in and write for The Wire?
Yeah, and that was just reporting-wise, that was some of my favorite parts of the book. Just because when you're writing a book or when you're writing an article, it's such a isolated endeavor, right? You have yourself and then you have an editor, and that's basically it before you release something out there. But when you come to a writer's room, you have David Simon and Pelicanos and Dennis Lehane and Richard Price and all these guys who have written best-selling major novels all coming together and arguing. And to me, it's a wonder that they ever were able to get work done, because, like Pelicanos said, at some point, for a while you're all arguing because you think you have the best story and you have the best ideas because you're used to working in isolation. But then after a while, you have to put your ego aside to actually come up with a story. And, David Simon a lot of times took charge in those endeavors. But, I mean, that was just some literary titans in one room together.
Yeah, I was blanking on Dennis Lehane. That was the guy I was trying to think of. It's a ridiculous. Well said by you. I think my favorite part, one of my favorite parts of your book, it just because I love this line, is when Pelicanos is discussing riding the line for Snoop when Michael kills her in the car, and Snoop famously says, "How's my hair look, Mike?" right before she dies. Probably one of the most famous lines on the show. It's got to be easily in the top five or top 10. What did you make when you interviewed both Felicia Pearson and Pelicanos, both about acting in that scene and Pelicanos writing that scene? Because as people will learn when they read your book, David Simon wasn't really sure about that line at first, but obviously, thankfully, they left it in and it becomes one of the most famous lines in the history of the show.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's just an ode to a great literary mind where, he just used his imagination to wonder how Snoop would what she would focus on before she died. And he said that this is a beautiful girl. She's never really talked about her looks before, but he just imagines that she would be concerned about how she looked before she dies. And, you know, that little line, I think Pelicanos urged them just to shoot it and David to decide whether or not he would leave it in or not. And I don't think they ever talked about it at all, but Pelicanos was like, I can tell that he liked it because he obviously left it in. And I mean, even before shooting that scene, Snoop and Tristan Wilds, the actor who played Michael Lee, who ends up killing her character, they were really, really close. So that was just off the screen. They were really, really close, where Snoop was introducing him to a lot of Baltimore because Tristan is from New York, and they were hanging out so much together off screen that that was really, really emotional day of shooting for those two.
The other thing I really liked in here is J.D. Williams, who played Bodie, who's obviously one of the, I think, most beloved characters on the show. He tells you really in great detail and with sort of great thoughtfulness how he knew Bodie eventually was going to be killed. And and that while everybody else, I think, around him was pretty heartbroken, he had a sense that's where his character was going, and he played it so professionally when you talk to the other actors. So that's the last thing I want to ask you about, just is that I thought J.D. Williams in the book was really cool. He really had, it seems like he had a great understanding of the character arc of Bodie.
Yeah, he called it. He could see Bodie start to deviate from the rules in this world, and he went up to David Simon and asked David Simon about it, and David's thing is that he never wants to tell an actor that his character is about to die because he doesn't want anything to be telegraphed, but he said once J.D. called it, he had to be honest with him and say that yes, but don't deviate from what you've been doing. You've been doing great. And yeah, this is the end of Bodie. I think J.D. Williams, it's funny because I've seen him in other stuff since, and that guy just never ages. He still looks exactly like Bodie.
Nothing better than McNulty and Bodie on the park bench when McNulty takes Bodie at least away from the corner, and they're sort of just discussing how, like, those two, they're all basically, you know, the famous line, basically, Bodie talking about it, that they're just pawns on the chessboard. That's a real great metaphor for The Wire, basically, that, like, ultimately, who has the power and who doesn't have the power. Lastly, Jonathan, 69 episodes of the show, correct?
60.
Okay. That's crazy to me, right? In that, like, you would think a show that had that kind of impact would have more, you know, would have like 150 episodes. But relatively speaking, it wasn't a long, long run in terms of the number of episodes, right?
No. And I mean, some of the seasons were stretched out as far as the delay between 3 and 4 and 4 and 5, just because David Simon was arguing with the HBO executives about trying to shoot another season. I mean, that's why it took so long. I think the show actually ran from, I want to say, late 2001 or to 2008 or so. So it took place over the span of 7 or 8 years and was only 5 seasons because he had to argue to get them to shoot the show.
Are you must be at this point, I saw you tweet out the other day that the book is already like in the top 50 of Amazon, at least in pre-orders. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I have Bill Simmons and Shay and yourself hyping me up, and I really appreciate that. But yeah, it's doing well so far. I mean, people love The Wire.
This book's going to do great. First of all, it's a great book, and second of all, you're correct. People love the show. They're fascinated by it, and the people who really care about it, I think, are just interested in how it came together. And, you know, I'm not saying this just because you're on this podcast. I said this before. There's never been a better piece that explains how this kind of remarkable show came together. So I give you a ton of props. You put your heart into this book clearly, and I think you're going to be rewarded with a lot of sales. And so if that is the case, I'm happy for you. The book is All the Pieces Matter. It's the inside story of The Wire. Jonathan Abrams is the author. You can find his work now on Bleacher Report. Those of you who are in the sports or who are sports media junkies know, obviously, that Jonathan previously worked for Grantland and the New York Times. Jonathan, hopefully this is a good warm-up for all the press coming your way. I appreciate you popping on this morning and coming on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Jonathan Abrams, The author of All the Pieces Matter, The Inside Story of The Wire. I think that book's going to do phenomenal. Thank you to Lou Pellegrino for producing this podcast, Cadence 13 in Sports Illustrated. Previous podcasts, if you want to check them out, we had the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Ted Jackson, who discusses his remarkable story about the search for Jackie Wallace, the story read by 10 million people or so. Investigative reporter Paula Levine of ESPN talking about her Michigan State reporting. A long conversation with Jim Nantz on working with Tony Romo and working at the Masters. Katie Nolan, Jamel Hill, Mike Francesa, Tara Lipinski, and Johnny Weir. And please check out those previous podcasts on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with Richard Deitch page. You can get that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. All right, my thanks again to Jonathan Amos. My thanks again to Lou Pellegrino. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.